Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
All right, it is Dave Plyer back with you here on 720 WGN. So tonight we are celebrating the legacy of legendary comedian Don Rickles. His best friend was another legendary comedian and Chicago's very own Bob Newhart. And it's no surprise that the two were also close friends. While their styles of comedy may have been different, the pair shared a strong bond, including their wives, that lasted a half a century. And to talk about that friendship and much more is comedy icon and my friend Bob Newhart. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Dave. Good to hear you.
Thank you, sir. You know, how are you, my friend? How's the weather out in on the West Coast these days?
The other day, I walked outside. It was about 7 o'clock at night, and it was gorgeous. Oh. It just was absolutely gorgeous. And it reminded me, that's why, you know, we live in California, because I grew up, spent 29 years in Chicago. I got drafted, and they sent me to California. And I said, how long has this been going on? I thought you had to freeze to death.
Yeah, not the best. But, you know, at least baseball is back. I actually got to go to the only Cubs game I went to so far this year. They won.
I don't know if I ever told you this story, but my wife and I, Ginny and I, this was 30 years ago, maybe more, we went to a Cub ball game, right? And we're sitting there, and between innings, these kids had run up and they'd ask for the autograph, and you say, during innings.
Sure.
And you sign away. So, and I never really thought about it. So years later, I'm doing the Tonight Show at NBC Burbank. And the Richard Pryor show was on, and the guest is John Belushi. Hmm. So I'm in the dressing room, knock at the door, it's John Belushi. And he said, hi, I'm John Belushi. I said, John, I know who you are. I admire your work. He said, do you remember going to a Cub ball game and a bunch of kids ran up and wanted your autograph? I said, yeah, sure, my wife and I, yeah. He said, I was one of those kids.
Wow. How cool is that? Something you'll always remember. And, you know, I look at how many people look up to you in the world of comedy and television for what you've accomplished all your life, Bob.
Thank you.
Absolutely. You know, your best friend, Don Rickles, you knew him better than anybody. And, you know, I know you know this, and he told his friends, and he told me, you know, I got to know him. I mean, you've known him a long time. I got to get to know him maybe the last 7-8 years of his life, and he always said when he was saying goodbye, he'd say, hey, and he grabbed my hand, and he'd be like, keep my name alive.
That was done, yeah. That's one of the last things he said to me.
Is that right?
We, my wife and I, Jenny and I, and of course Barbara, and we were very close friends, and we knew Don was probably not going to make it, but he didn't want us to see him. He didn't want us to see him, wasting away as he was. I think when he passed, I think he was 130 pounds or something like that. But one of the last things he said to me was, keep my name alive.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when he died, the day he died, he said, he told Barbara, his wife, he said, I'm going to go see Larry. That was his son, Larry, who died a number of years ago.
Yeah.
Wow. He was quite a guy.
Yeah. So many guys gave him nicknames, like the Merchant of Venom, Mr. Warmth. I mean, but you know what? If you really did get to know this man, he was just the sweetest man on the planet. Am I right?
Yeah, he was. It's what people don't know about him. But we had a conversation here with this part of the city we live in. Jane Fonda lives in this area. And she said she was always afraid of Don, of running into him. And we said, if Don thought he offended you, he'd feel terrible.
He'd feel terrible.
He would. Because it was all done. You know, it's a legal term. It's the assumption of risk. But when you go to see Don Rickles in a nightclub,
it's assumption of risk.
it's a badge of honor to be. I remember there was one time, Ginny and I, Don was in the main room at the Sahara in Vegas, which is where he played, and we're sitting in the booth with Barbara and he's picking on this guy, picking on that guy, this woman, that woman. And there's this guy in the front, very front row, has one of the worst hair pieces I've ever seen. It looked like an animal died on this guy's head. And Don keeps going back, and I'm going like, Don. And I'm trying to signal him. He walks by, and he looks down, and he says, "No one would ever guess, sir."
That's awesome. That is awesome. I mean, to be insulted by him, I mean, like, you know, for people that, you know, especially in the business, it was an honor for a lot of people, especially those roasts and so forth, to be roasted by him and to be insulted by him. That was, I must have seen him a couple dozen times, and I was up in Milwaukee, and he knew I was there, and I was in Vegas with him too, and he called me out, and he goes, I just want to call my good friend Dave Pliers here from Chicago from WGN Radio, and everyone clapped. Nobody knows who I was, but it was whatever. They gave me a nice clap, and he looks at me and he goes, "I appreciate you coming. I know you have a busy schedule." And then he rolled his eyes and looked backwards, and I thought, yes, that's all I wanted was to be busted Don Rickles.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But now, you know, when you two, you know, became friends, it really started with your wives. It started with Ginny and Barbara, didn't it?
Yeah. Ginny knew Barbara before Barbara was married to Don. Ginny was dating this agent, and he was Don's agent, and Barbara was this agent's secretary. His name was Jack Gilardi.
Mm-hmm.
He's with the GAC.
Yep.
And so she would talk. So we're in Vegas. Ginny and I are married. We got married in '63. So we're in Vegas. This is maybe '66, something like that. And she said, and of course, I was in the main room, I guess, at the Desert Inn. And Don's in the lounge at the Sahara.
Mm-hmm.
So Ginny said, we're both there at the same time. Ginny said, "I'm going to call Barbara, and we'll have to get together, you know, and we'll have dinner or something between shows." And I said, "Great, yeah." I'd never met Don. You know, I knew of Don, of course, but I never met him.
Yeah.
So we go in, and we went into like a cafeteria at the Sahara, and I'm talking to Barbara, and Jenny's talking to Don, and we're waiting to go into his 3 o'clock in the morning show in the lounge, and Don, he's going backstage to get dressed. So Ginny and I are walking with Barbara into the lounge. And Ginny said, "You know, he is just, he's the sweetest man in the world. He just, we were talking and they just had their daughter, Mindy."
Mm.
And, mm-hmm. And, you know, he's tired of being on the road. He just wants to get home with his family. And I said, "Well, honey, you know, his act is a little different." And she said, "Well, you always say that about other comedians." "Okay," she said. "So I think he's just wonderful." So, okay, so we go, and they put us from the very front row in the lounge. Don comes out. First thing he says, "The stammering idiot from Chicago's in the audience with his hooker wife from Bayonne, New Jersey."
Oh, my God. So was Ginny stunned, or was...
Her jaw fell. I tried to tell you, but anyway, we became great friends.
All right, Dave Plyer, we're talking to comedy legend Bob Newhart about his longtime friendship with Don Rickles. And by the way, there's a charming documentary out there by Judd Apatow called Bob and Don, A Love Story, and you can watch it on YouTube. So, Bob, you and Don traveled together with your wives. You're Catholic, St. Ignatius, Loyola grad.
Yeah.
Don was Jewish. You guys went to the Vatican, and he always, always talked about, you know, going to Catholic Mass, and it was very complicated. And you know, I went up and got the cookie, which you're talking about the host. And he goes, "You know, we just go to the synagogue and write a check, and then we're out of there. Like, you know, you're Catholics, it's Jorgen and it's this and whatever." But he was always fascinated by the Catholic Church.
We used to, you know, we celebrate Jewish holidays with Don, the Seders and things like that. We go to their house and read from the books, you know, and have the bitter herbs and do the whole, you know, and Don, and then we went to see the Pope. I didn't make arrangements. I was going to make arrangements to maybe, you know, see the Pope with a smaller audience,
mm-hmm.
But I didn't know if Don would like it, so. It turns out Carol O'Connor happened to be in Rome at the time, so he arranged for us along with 7,500 other people to see the Pope. Well, Don never let me forget about that.
That's awesome.
I knew how, you know, used all his pull within the Vatican. And
that's awesome. Well, you know what's funny, though? I mean, but he needed you as much as you needed him on these trips, too, because you as an accountant, you figured out all the trips. You reconciled it. You converted money. Like, you were the guy that was kind of in charge of these excursions, weren't you?
Yeah, but between Barbara and myself, an airport, maybe Heathrow in London. I forget which one it was, but I was going to go cash the money, change it into English pounds, and then we're going on to Venice, and so get an Italian lira, and Barbara was going to check on the plane with it. So the two of us wandered off, and Jenny and Don are there with our luggage, and I walked away, and I said, Barbara, and I said to Barbara, I said, you know, if we left right now, if we went back to the States, they would still be here 7 years from now.
Sitting on the luggage.
Sitting on the trunks, wondering what happened to us.
That's awesome. No, but as I
now,
said.
One time, we were in London. I'll never forget this. We went over for I think it was Prince Charles was having a fundraiser. So Jenny and I flew over. We were invited to participate, as was Cary Grant and a lot of other people. And now we're in the plane waiting for the plane to leave Heathrow and go back to L.A. And I'm sitting with Cary Grant, right? And Jenny said, I'm going to get... I want to get some curios for the kids. You know, whenever we went away, we could bring the kids back toys of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
And Cary Grant said, yeah, okay. He said, Bob and I, we'll look over the luggage. Don't worry about it, Jenny. And I thought to myself, Cary Grant just called me Bob.
Yeah, isn't that awesome? Isn't that awesome? See, even as an actor, as a comedian, as successful you are, the people that you grew up with and watched in the movies or on television, whatever, I mean, that's still an exciting moment, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, Cary Grant.
Wow. That's awesome. Dinners. You guys did so many dinners together, too. I mean, it just must have been nonstop. And I think about this. I mean, you guys did it for... over 5 decades of going out, traveling together and so forth. I mean, you guys were inseparable.
Yeah, the first one was, I think we went to the Caribbean. Then we went to, I'll tell you, our favorite city was Venice. We go to Venice whenever we had a chance. It was just, we'd be in the square, St. Mark's Square. And having a beer or whatever, and just watching the people walk by, and it was that was our favorite city. That was our favorite city. Yeah.
Nice, very nice, very very nice. You know, Don, and both you and Don were frequent guests on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and You know, and I think those were the moments, like when you were Don or some of the legends in comedy, you would, like, I was too young, and, you know, I was born in the late 60s. So, like, I was a kid, but I would sneak back downstairs and kind of peek around the corner and watch the TV because there's legends on TV that would just make you laugh out loud. My parents never knew it, but even with, it's true. But even, you know, with you, not only did you, were a guest, but, you hosted the show. You actually were doing a few weeks in a row when Carson was in one of his salary disputes. I think it was 1970. You know,
that's right. Yeah, and, that's right. Yeah,
and you got to do 3 weeks almost as an audition to take that spot.
Well, I didn't realize it at the time, but apparently NBC and Johnny were at odds, mm-hmm. And NBC's position was, we're going to find somebody else. So they tried me and several other people. David Brenner, I think, was one.
Sure.
And I didn't know this was going on. So I filled in. It was in New York. Johnny was still in New York, whatever that would have been, and probably in the 70s somewhere. And I did 3 weeks. And at the end of the 3 weeks, I mean, I was exhausted.
It was a lot.
I was absolutely worn out from having to read the books or pieces of the book for that the author had written and trying to get notes on the. And this man did it for 30 years. I was a wet noodle, you know, by at the end of this 3 weeks, and this man did it for 30 years.
You were one of the top three most frequent guest hosts. Like, it was, you're in the top three. Like, it was Joan Rivers, Joey Bishop, and you. And you hosted 87 times, I believe. I mean, that's,
yeah, I think so. Yeah,
not a slacker,
yeah,
either. I mean, they must have loved what you did, of course. And then you had the hit series, so why not? And I'll talk to you in the fall around your birthday, my friend.
Okay. All right, Dave, I look forward to it.
Thank you. The legendary.
As I do each year.
As you do each year. That's right. Thank you, my friend. Thanks for spending the time with us tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Bob Newhart. All right, our celebration of the late, great Don Rickles continues with my conversation with Don backstage in Vegas right after the top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on 720 WGN.
We are backstage in Las Vegas at the Orleans Hotel and Casino with a comedy legend that has entertained us for nearly 65 years. He's an actor, a comedian, an author, an Emmy Award winner. Don has performed for 4 U.S. presidents, traveled the world with his lovely wife Barbara and his best friends Bob and Ginny Newhart. I thought I'd drop his name in there.
Yeah. No, he'll check that out.
I'm sure he will. And that is the legendary Don Rickles. Don, good evening, and happy 90th birthday to you.
I always say me and Harry Truman. May 8th.
That's the day. And I wanted to talk about your very beginnings. The very beginnings that developed into the Don Rickles we know today. You were the class clown, not great in school. You were the president of your high school class. Where did you get your sense of humor?
Well, you know, I really don't know. My mother was not a person that did humor. She, great personality. My father was a terrific salesman, but not a jokester, so to speak. It just came, from being around guys. I was always, even in the Navy, and well, that's further on in my life, but when I was a very young guy, I always kidded around in school, and it became me. I really don't have a basis to say, well, my Uncle Charlie or something, but it's not so. I just, and my mother encouraged it, you know, to kid around, not dreaming I would be doing
sure.
this.
Friends, family members.
Yeah,
that
right.
Type of thing.
I'd get up at the party, at the bat mitzvah, at the wedding, and say something.
Now, you left the Navy at the end of the war, and thank you for your service, by the way. Oh. You went to school at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts, class of 48, with the likes of Grace Kelly, Jason Robards, Anne Bancroft, Charles Durning. Very prestigious school.
It was, and I was very fortunate because they said I'd never attain that because I was always kind of loud and strong. And it was a guy called Phil Loeb, rest his soul. Look how I remember his name now. He's a great director, and he passed away. And I used to go, good evening, you know, from the stage and all. And he said, take it easy, take it. He said, but never lose that energy. And that energy was the basis of my humor, and that helped me a great deal.
And attitude.
Yeah. Well, see, my whole humor is based on not so much the joke, really, but, of course, it's the attitude of what I say.
You're not a joke teller. I mean,
no,
you know, I've heard you say,
you.
If you give me $1 million and go out and say, you know, you're a comedian, but you're not a joke teller. You did some impressions for a while.
Yes, I did.
In the early days.
Oh, God, yes.
But talking to the audience is really what made you who you are.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. And everything I've done to this very day, except for television, Everything I've done on the stage is what I created in the car, in the house, the bathroom.
Yeah.
It's never been written on paper.
Right.
And I just added and added and kept saying it. Became a performance.
Sure. And there was no Comedy Central, there was no Comedy Store, no Tonight Show when you got started. Comedians worked other venues. You worked burlesque houses and strip clubs.
Yeah. I worked at what they call strip joints with the girls, Satina, taking off her clothes. And those days there was not that much clothes taken off. And I was like the comedian in between, you know, with the talking, again, talking to the audience and making stupid jokes and throwing in a few impressions. And that's how I kept going and joining terrible places.
And there are places, three names that I've always heard you talk about, and in your book too. The three places were Slate Brothers, Murray Franklin's, and the Copacabana. The three names are always Johnny Carson, Frank Sinatra, and Dean Martin. And I want to first talk to you a little bit about the Slate Brothers.
Yeah, well, there was a guy called Henry Slate, rest his soul. He was a good guy, and I worked for, like, Peanuts, and I used to get dressed in the kitchen, you know. The fellow called Harry Gomes, rest his soul, who was with me for 40 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And he used to help me get dressed in the kitchen. I always wanted to wear a tuxedo. That was my thing.
Yeah. And a real bow tie.
Yeah. And I worked and it's like, it was like a little store.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, I started to do what I do, making fun of people. And suddenly, stars started to show up, little by little, you know. And they said, oh, Sinatra was in the other night, and Rickles did blah, blah, blah. Or Charlton Heston came by, you know. And I used to do stuff about these women and so forth. And it caught on, and it was an exciting time.
Well, they wanted to be insulted by you. I mean, yeah, they caught on that was cool.
And, you know, they used the word insult, and it's an attitude. It's not mean-spirited. I've never, in my opinion, never hurt anybody. You know, I never hit below the belt or anything. Even when it came to mobsters who come to see me in those days.
Sure.
And so I made jokes about them, but they laughed because it was kind and it was funny.
And you
Mickey Cohn, he used to arrest us. So he used to come in and sit. I don't think Tony ever knew this. And he used to sit in the front with his dog. He had his dog. And he put the dog in the chair and sit there and laugh his hand on. And I would kid about the dog. And so
of course you would.
That's what he did. He thought it was a riot.
That's great. And I know Murray Franklin's came along, and your mother, your dear mother, God rest her soul, played a big part in getting Frank to come see you at Murray Franklin's.
Yeah, well, she went up to Dolly, up at the Fontainebleau, I say, in the performance. And spoke to her and said, if you get Frank to see my Donnie, she'll let me Donnie. And she said, don't edit it. Don't worry, edit it. I'll take care of it. And sure enough, a couple of nights later, Frank came in with a few of his friends, and that was it.
More of my backstage conversation in Las Vegas with the late, great Don Rickles right after this on 720 WGN.
TV producers at the time thought you were too hot to handle, but on the night of October 7th, 1965, you made your first appearance on The Tonight Show, over 100 appearances, as we were saying, over three decades. How did you first meet Johnny? How did that all come about?
Well, it was in New York. I don't exactly know how we met, but he heard about me in the Elegant. That was the place my manager owned, and I was very successful there, and people used to come and see. So, you know, word got around, and then his people asked if I'd come on the show. And we hit it off great. And from the very day we met, if the paper said, we're going to talk about trains tonight, and he'd look at the paper and said, how's your mother, you know? And I'd say, you never liked my mother. Why did you bring that up? And we'd start to do 20 minutes about mothers, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And your mother never liked me. Why is that? You know? And he was great. He picked right up on it. And we always had fun.
And he was the kind of guy that made you funny. He was a great setup artist, and he wanted you to shine.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And Johnny was pretty much, socially, was kind of a loner, you know.
Yeah,
we went out socially occasionally, but he wasn't a guy that participated. He was uncomfortable with a lot of people, and yet when the light went on, he was the best.
Same with David Letterman, and I know it was...
Letterman had that thing, too.
Yeah. Did you, in the earlier days of knowing Johnny, did you hang out with him more really in the 60s a little bit more?
No, it was never hanging out with Johnny. It was... Or dinner date, or doing the show and have dinner with him afterwards.
Okay.
Or when his birthday came, we were at the house and a few people. But he was very, very, very close with his life.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have not so much a popular moment, but do you have a favorite moment out of 100 plus appearances on the show that you love talking about an experience you had on the air with Johnny? Like, what was your favorite?
Well, I can't see. There were so many wonderful times.
Yeah.
There was a time when he threw me into the pool.
The Japanese.
That was talked about a great deal.
Yeah.
And there was one other time when I...
With Sinatra, you know, when Frank was on the show, and he didn't make a lot of appearances on The Tonight Show, but then you walked out on stage. You came
That was another thing. It's on the film, in the show here tonight.
One of my favorite moments of all time. Share with us that story that Frank told about you. You weren't married to Barbara yet. You were dating a pretty girl, and you walked over to Frank's table.
You know, it's funny you should say that, because the wife said to me upstairs, "Don, stop telling that story."
Did she really? Best story.
Everybody
I love that
in
story.
The world, the newspaper people, everybody picked up on that story. One guy said it happened in Shanghai. One guy said it happened in China. One guy said it happened in North Korea. I mean, from a little story like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's true. The punchline is, you know, it's with this girl, blah, blah, blah. Wanted to score with her. And he was in the coat in the sands in the lounge. I went over and said, he called me Bullethead. I said, Frank, he said, what is it, Bullethead? I said, if you could come over and help me out with the girl, blah, 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 blah. Okay, not right away. But I said, don't worry. Okay. And so I sat down with her. She said, do you know Frank Sinatra? I said, oh, sweetheart. Come on. Sure enough, she was getting all supports there. He came over and said, hey, Don, how are you? And I said, hey, Frank, can't you see I'm eating? and he fell off living. Then he had the security cops, which nobody, you know, picked me up and carried me out.
There was another story, and I've only heard you tell it once, and I don't even remember what show it was on. And I was a kid when I heard the story, and you were talking about being with Jilly Rizzo, and after a performance, you guys were sitting down having some vodka, some Jack Daniels, whatever it was at the time, and there was thunder outside and lightning. Yeah. Share with us that story.
Yeah. Well, it was in Italy. We were sitting in a hotel at the big bay window. You know, boom, 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 boom. Lights were going, thunder and rain. And frankly, we were all having vodka, just the three of us. And he kept saying, tell those reporters to stop. and it was raining. I said, well, Frank, it's, don't check me around. I want you to go out here, Jillian. Tell them to stop it. I want to stop. Because the lightning was coming into it. And we had tuxedos on. We went out soaking wet in the rain. Now, you people, stop it. Stop it. Just stop it.
What would you like me to tell the next generation and more of these young kids about Don Rickles?
That was a guy that was interested in making the people laugh. The people, and to do things they understood, and to do things that are happening in their life, and projected and exaggerated. That's it.
All right, Mr. Warmth, the Merchant of Venom, Bullethead are just a couple of the nicknames of the late legendary Don Rickles. And for those of you who listen to my show, you know I honor Don every year on the anniversary of his birth. Bob Newhart and Tony Opodisano, Don's former manager, routinely join me for that in an effort to keep his name alive, something he asked me and countless others to do for him so people would not forget him. Now, riding on a wave of success that lasted more than 60 years, Don is best known as the insult comic who skewered presidents, royalty, celebrities, and friends and fans alike. But there was more to this man than a devilish ear-to-ear grin and lightning-fast put-downs. He was a loving husband, an adoring father, who suffered a devastating loss, a loyal friend of the likes of Bob Newhart and Frank Sinatra. Don was a young student of the American Academy of Dramatic Arts with future stars Jason Robards and Don Murray and Grace Kelly, and intended to become a seriously committed actor. But it was nightclubs where he found his success. The Merchant of Venom traces Don's career from his rise in the 50s to a late-in-life resurgence thanks to the Toy Story franchise, his role in Casino, and scores of TV appearances from Carson to Kimmel. And in real life, as I got to know him myself, he was the sweetest man on earth. The author is Michael Starr, television reporter and columnist for the New York Post for nearly 30 years, and he joins us here on WGN. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Dave. How are you?
I am great. You know, I do love everything and anything Rickles, and I was excited when I heard the book was coming out, and it's truly a great tribute to him.
Thank you. You know, I too, obviously, am a big Don Rickles fan. When I write books, I've written other celebrity biographies, I always feel like I'm going to need to write about somebody I'm going to want to spend a lot of time with.
Mm-hmm.
In research and writing, and Don to me was that way. He was one of my show business heroes. I grew up in the 70s, and to me, seeing Don on The Tonight Show, especially when Frank Sinatra was there, that was appointment TV before there was appointment TV. I mean, you didn't have you couldn't DVR it or whatever. You had to catch Don. Sometimes he would just walk on the show unannounced, sit down, and just start ripping whoever was sitting next to him on the couch, including Ed McMahon and including Johnny.
Absolutely. And, yeah, no question. I was going to say in the 70s, same with me, as I was very young. I was, I'm barely 10 years old by the end of the 70s, and I would, when I'd see his name in the TV guide, I just knew it was going to be funny. I'd keep myself up. I'd walk downstairs, hide kind of behind the TV room door, and just and watch it, because it was always laugh out loud funny.
It was, and I think, you know, that, and thank you for that introduction. You covered a lot of ground there, and I think one of the things you touched upon was the fact that, yes, Don was known as the Merchant of Venom, and Mr. Warmth, which is his favorite nickname, popularized by Johnny Carson. In the 50s, he was called the Insultant Sultan, which, for reasons we all know, never caught on. It was, wasn't a real great nickname, but he really was a nice guy, and he really wanted to be known as a nice guy who's, it was all an act, all an onstage act. And you're absolutely right. You know, in his final years, he just wanted people to keep his name alive. And I hope that this contributes to that and gives people a good sense of, you know, the arc of Don's career and growing up here in New York and in Jackson Heights, Queens, and trying to become a serious dramatic actor, which didn't quite work out, although he did have some good roles in movies later on. But happenstance, and he became, you know, quote unquote, an insult comic, and just went, there was nobody doing what he was doing at the time, and he just rose to the top. And through a lot of hard work and working a lot of crappy clubs along the way, you know, in his climb to the top, and finally in the late 50s, early 60s, really made it to the peak, and continued his success through the end, all the way through the end of his life.
Absolutely, no question. You know, you've written so many biographies over the years, Ringo Starr, Red Fox, books on Joey Bishop, Art Carney, William Shatner, Peter Sellers, Bobby Darin. You know, the fact that you chose Rickles, because, I mean, you're right. When you're writing a book like this, you want to spend time really with the people that knew him, the research that you have to do. You're spending time with Don, essentially, really doing all this research, and I think you did an amazing job here. You know, the big clubs are where Don really found his footing. So you mentioned he was, you know, exploring drama and so forth, and right, had a bunch of great movies, but it was like Murray Franklin's, the Slate Brothers. You know, he first played Vegas in its infancy in 1959, and it's where he really found who he was and how he was going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the clubs are one thing, and Don was great at that. But when he got to Vegas, it's a different audience. You have people from all over the country. He had never played there before. This is in 1959, and he was at the Sahara Hotel.
Yeah.
His services were being bid for by several of the hotel casinos, and he was an immediate smash from the get-go. Although he wasn't playing the big room, he was playing, you know, this like midnight to 5 a.m. show in a smaller lounge, but people were coming to, all the celebrities were coming to see him.
After their shows.
Exactly. And he had to learn how to sort of pace his act for people who were coming in very early in the morning, or, you know, just they were going about to eat breakfast or whatever it was, or they just lost. But he, in the casino, but he was such a good bomb for that, for whoever wanted to be entertained at that time of the night and the morning. And it really stood him in good stead because he learned how to pace his act, how to, you know, deal with hecklers, how to deal with people, you know, eating food sometimes, or the bartender you can hear in the background. And it really stood him in good stead for when he did play the bigger rooms, which he eventually did, of course, in Vegas and New York and Miami Beach and all across the country.
Well, Vegas, you know, we said 59. I think he was there till 87 minus a few years. He was, I think, at the Riviera, but then he was at the Golden Nugget, and that's where Steve Wynn took him. He played the Tropicana, the Desert Inn, the Stardust, but, you know, he was off strip at the New Orleans for years, and that's where I saw him probably the most in the last 10 years, was either there or Chicago or Milwaukee or Atlantic City. I mean, if I was in a city where he was performing, I always went to go see him, and I think that was true for a lot of people.
Yes, and you know, and Don sort of, he not only was he doing his stand-up act in Vegas and touring constantly across the country, but he was finding time, especially in the 60s, to appear in countless sitcoms like I Dream of Jeannie and The Addams Family and Get Smart.
Oh, he was always popping up. Oh, yeah.
Night shows, yeah. You know, a week went by where you couldn't turn your television set on and see Don on The Beverly Hillbillies, or, you know, one of those
Gilligan's
shows.
Island, The Twilight Zone. There was tons of them, yeah.
He was all over the place, and some dramas, too. And I think he wanted to sort of keep his hand in acting. And yes, he was unbelievably successful doing his stage act. That's what he was known for. But he also wanted to be known as a sitcom actor, and it didn't quite work out the way he wanted it to. But he had several sitcoms, two called The Don Rickles Show on ABC and CBS.
Right, right.
Then he had CPO Sharkey on NBC, which
mildly,
you know, yes, which was mildly successful. It was two seasons, which for Don was like, you know, a great
a lifetime. It was a lifetime,
right? And yeah. And because I think the reason for that was, it's hewed very closely. You know, Don was in the Navy in World War II.
Right.
He was in the Navy for 2 years.
Right.
And, you know, honorably discharged and got close to battle, didn't quite see action, but got close to it. And so CPO Sharkey, he played, you know, a chief petty officer in the Navy, which Don knew all about. And he knew the terminology and he knew that lifestyle. So I think that's one of the reasons why CPO Sharkey works so well. In addition to having a great supporting cast, where his other sitcoms tried to put him as, you know, the put-upon dad, the suburban dad.
Wasn't him. Yeah.
With Richard Lewis, you know, he did a Fox sitcom called
Daddy Durst. Yeah.
Yeah, where that was also a little sort of closer to his stage persona. But I think, and you know, I say this in the book and have others saying it in the book, it was really hard to write a character for Don to fit into that format, in 22-minute format.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, it just, you know, and it sort of took something away because you had to see him live. That's where you really got the full force of his personality and his comedic style.
Don Rickles, The Merchant of Venom, the author is Michael Starr, and there's more after this on 720 WGN. Dave Player, 720 WGN. We're talking to Michael Starr, author of many biographies, including Don Rickles, The Merchant of Venom. You talked touched a little bit about the fact that Don was going to get into dramatic acting. And, you know, his movies, though, the ones that he was in, most of them, I should say. Let's talk 1959. He made his film debut in Run Silent, Run Deep with Clark Gable, Burt Lancaster. Always had great stories about that. Kelly's Heroes, Clint Eastwood, Telly Savalas, Carol O'Connor. A classic, which, by the way, he made lifelong friends in the movies he was in.
He did. And Carol O'Connor was a very good friend
very
of his.
Good.
And as a matter of fact, Carol O'Connor tried his hand, you know, inspired by Don at a stage routine. I think it did fairly well, but he wasn't an insult comic like Don. But yes, I mean, he in those movies that he made a movie called The Rat Trap with Debbie Reynolds and Tony Curtis. He got a lot of acclaim for that. He was always in with big stars, even in a kind of a schlocky movie like The Man with the X-Ray Eye.
Yes.
Ray Milland.
Yeah.
You know, and
the beach movies.
So the Beach Blanket Bingo movies with, you know, Annette Funicello and Frankie Avalon. So he was always sort of there in the zeitgeist in the movies, although that wasn't his primary focus of entertainment. He did like to keep his hand in it, and he was always available and always was wanted for these movies. And then, yes, as you mentioned in your intro, later in life, I think he figured his crowning achievement in Don's eyes was Casino, because you had De Niro and Joe Pesci and Martin Scorsese directing, and he didn't have a huge role, but he had enough of a role to make an impact.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Toy Story, which opened him up to a whole generation of kids.
But Casino, I mean, Casino was legendary as well. But, you know, and I love seeing Don in those roles, but it was television. And, you know, when you think about who was Don's idol growing up, is the guy who gave him the nickname The Merchant of Venom, which was Milton Berle. And, you know, he always said he looked up to Milton. But, you know, it was really Johnny Carson and Sinatra that, he really made an impact with and helped him all along with his career. And Johnny on The Tonight Show was really the pinnacle.
Yeah, it was. And also Dean Martin.
Dean Martin, it was Rose.
Yeah, there's a section in the book when Don first appeared on the Dean Martin Show. They weren't doing the roast yet, but they devoted, it was an unprecedented amount of airtime. I think it was like 14 minutes to Don. It was a roast format where they brought Don in and he didn't know who was going to be there. They set it up like a nightclub and he came in 14, 15 minutes of prime time uninterrupted. It was just unheard of. But he did so well there, and that really cemented his, you know, along with his appearances on The Tonight Show, and then a little later on, The Joey Bishop Show, and Merv Griffin, and he did all the talk shows, Dinah Shore, because he was such a great guest, and they could always count on him to get laughs and to come on and just be the Merchant of Venom, but also show his softer side. And I think that's what people and his fellow celebrities really loved about Don.
You know, Jeff Sotzing, who's Johnny Carson's nephew, he runs Carson Entertainment and all the properties that they have. I had him on back in August when the anniversary of The Tonight Show with Johnny was happening. And he said that, you know, there were very few people that Johnny didn't have notes in front of, outside of maybe a little index card that said where Don was performing. There was no need for that when Rickles would come on stage, because it just kind of Johnny just stood back and let Don do his thing and responded as best he could. But it was Don's show for when he was on.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Dave. I mean, he sort of took the show over for those few minutes. And it's also interesting to know that when, you know, Don was also remembered for all the Dean Martin celebrity roasts, which came a short time after the Dean Martin show. They made a whole format out of that. He was always the last on and also the only celebrity whose lines were not written for him because, like, as you just, he didn't need it. It almost didn't matter who was on the dais. He'd come in and do his thing and rip everybody and then, you know, in his talks and close the show because, as Tom Dreesen says in the book, a fellow comedian, nobody could top him. I mean, it was just, you close the show with Rickles and you had it made.
You talk about a lot of his friendships. You talk about his family life. Bob Newhart, you know, they never did really anything substantial on screen together to speak of, but Don and Barbara, Bob and Ginny, they were inseparable for decades.
Yes, they were inseparable friends. They toured the world together. Bob Newhart called Don the sweetest man he'd ever known. I think Don felt the same way about Bob Newhart, even though their comedic styles were complete polar opposites. And, you know, it's interesting to note that there's that famous episode on The Tonight Show where Bob Newhart was hosting The Tonight Show and Don slammed down Johnny's cigarette box. And then, you know, people, you can watch it on YouTube the next night. Carson took a microphone and went across the hall to CPO Sharkey and surprised, shocked him.
Yeah.
Pretty much. You know, it was all set up beforehand. Don didn't know. You know, Rickles, did you break my cigarette box? You know, and it was like one of the only times Don was speechless.
It was uncommon to do like a behind the scenes, grab the mic, let's get the cord, bring the camera, let's go. Yeah, I mean, they might have planned it, but yeah, Rickles had no idea. But that was the beauty of the relationship and the friendship, not only with Newhart, but with Carson as well.
Yes, I think so. You know, it was a very meta moment before we knew what meta moments were, you know, back in the 70s. But yes, Don had a lot of friends, and you mentioned before his idol, Milton Berle, his fellow comics, not so much with, although I don't know how, I don't know how much of it was really drummed up in the press, but with another insult comic from that era, Jack Leonard, Fat Jack Leonard, who actually was commented more about Don than Don did about him. I think that Fat Jack was always felt that Don took borrowed a little bit of his act, but you know, the fact was that Don did what he did and he was so good at it that he became very famous. Fat Jack Leonard had a modicum of fame, but never reached those heights. And there was probably a little bit of bitterness there, but they never, you know, Don never said anything bad about Jack Leonard in public. And as a matter of fact, Fat Jack Leonard sponsored Don for a membership in the Friars Club. So, you know, it was probably just a lot of, you know, those quote unquote, those showbiz feuds that, you know, it makes for good copy. But, Don was pretty much beloved by everybody. I mean, it was just just who he was. And he was, as you mentioned, Dave, several times, he was just a nice guy off stage, and that certainly helps. You know, you can have a terrific act on stage and then be a total jerk.
Yeah,
off stage, which we know that there were a lot of personalities who were that way, but Don was not.
And we only touch the surface on the book, and there's a lot of in-depth stories in here that I know you haven't heard. Don Rickles, The Merchant of Venom, it's a great read, available on Amazon and your local bookseller as well. Makes a great gift as well. Michael, a pleasure, and really, congratulations. Terrific book.
Thank you, Dave, and anytime, and thanks for having me on the show.
All right, well, Don's road manager, who is also Frank Sinatra's manager, will join us next after the top stories from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. And to talk about it all is my good friend, Tony Opitasano. Tony, what's going on, my friend?
I'm doing fine, David. It's great to talk with you again.
You know what? A long time coming, because we've talked all the time for the better part of 6 or 7 years, and, you know, we always said, you know, when's this going to be a book? When is this going to come out? And there's something you said to me really early on, and you said, you know, I've got some great stories, but I would only tell the stories that Frank would be okay with me telling. And I thought that just said a lot about you.
Well, it's just something else that I think we had in common, you know, telling someone something in confidence and knowing that it would stay there. That speaks a lot about a friendship. And, you know, 23 years or 230 years, I don't plan to violate that confidence no matter what. And, you know, I'll tell you a quick funny aside. When I was taking meetings about actually bringing this book to fruition, that question came up, and they said, well, you know, what about, what do you think you're going to tell? And there are things, you know, are there things that you wouldn't tell? And I said, well, yeah, sure. I said, there are things that I won't tell. I said, for two reasons. One is that I wouldn't want to break the confidence that we had in each other. I said, jokingly, and the other one is, I said, I know things that could possibly put me in a grave. So everyone in the meeting laughed. And one guy said, he says, well, I got an idea. I said, what's that? He says, how about we have you write two books and we'll publish the second one after you're dead?
You know, he's not wrong. That might be a good idea. That might be. I said there's going to be a part two. I'm sure you didn't fill all these stories into one book because you've got so many of them. And here's the thing about this. You might have not told, you know, dirty stories that you shouldn't have been telling, but you've told stories that really no one's ever heard because you've had a firsthand account for so many years with Frank. And I got to tell you, I love the way the book is laid out. You open up talking about the call you got in 98 and the opportunity you had to say goodbye to Frank, but then you pulled it back and pivoted to your story.
The general public, I think, would probably get more out of the book if they had just a slight vested interest in who I was and the commonalities of lifestyle and upbringing and everything else that Frank and I had that we shared, you know, our family history, our ethnicities, our childhoods, the struggles to be in the business when one of our parents on both sides didn't really want us to be in the business. And I just thought that it would help the reader be invested in the journey.
Well, you were born in Brooklyn, right? I mean, so some parallels to Frank's early years as well. And your father, and I love this, once told you that he should have known you'd be hobnobbing with the rich and famous because as a kid, you liked classy things. I like that.
Yeah, he said, I had a private suite 20 minutes out of your mother, and you had a private suite. I said, Dad, that was an incubator. What are you talking about?
Private suite. Nice. Nice. Well, I mean, you know, at a very young age, you know, you started playing the piano, the accordion, the guitar, and you were 13. I love the story that when you were in a Woolworth store, when you first discovered, you know, Frank's music and one of his albums.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The Nearness of You. I went home and put that thing on, and just the richness of that voice opening that song a cappella, you know, it absolutely sent shivers through my spine. It just blew me away. It's not the pale moon. And then all of a sudden, Bill Miller came in on piano, and then the orchestra followed. Absolutely beautiful. I was hooked.
Well, and
immediately.
And then fast forward, so to 1972, just 8 years. 8 years after you first discovered mm-hmm. Frank's music. At 21, yeah. you met Sinatra and Gilly, I might add, but in the middle, really, of what was his self-imposed retirement, so to speak. So he really wasn't out there that much, but it was about mm-hmm. 2 a.m, and you met Gilly and talked to him, and he asked you to pick up a guitar, and the rest is history.
Yeah, well, I had already at that point had about a 6 month, 8 month history with Gilly because I discovered the club by way of a recording that Frank made in 1965 live at the Sands with the Basie Band, and he kept talking about Gilly's and Gilly's and Gilly's, and I'm saying, you know, when I get old enough to start playing clubs in the city, I got to check this place out. And I went in, and it was right next door to what was the Alvin Theater back in those days. Now it's the Gershwin. And there was a club still there. It's now called the Russian Samovar, 256 West 52nd. But Uncle Frank, Gilly's older brother, ran the club in his absence when he was on the road with Frank, with the singer. And so I struck up an accord with Uncle Frank, and then he said, you got to meet my brother, and Gilly and I clicked. And then Gilly, when he got to know me a bit, knew that I didn't have any kind of an agenda, he said, I think I'd like to introduce you to the old man. I think you guys would be a good fit. And so, yeah, that night, Frank had come into New York because Frank Jr. was appearing at the Rainbow Room, and they were going to the midnight show, and Gilly called me, and he said, don't talk it up, but the old man's going to be in town. If you're doing a gig or something, swing by the club. I want to put you two guys together. And that's how it started.
Wow. Wow. And it was picking up a guitar and just start playing 2 a.m. after a couple Jack Daniels, mm-hmm. more than a couple Jack Daniels.
Yeah. Arbitrarily he would close the club. Well, technically he would close the club at 4:00, but if you backed yourself up with 3 rounds, he wouldn't chase you out till 5:30, depending on what kind of mood he was in. You know, as long as no cash went across the bar, everything was cool.
Yeah, right.
So this particular night, he closed the club right at 4, chased everybody out. He says, the old man wants to hang out, and I want him to hear you play. So he had me sit in with the trio, with Joe Patrone and Lou Berryman. And we clicked. We were there till about 6 or 6:30 in the morning. And it was just... I kept pinching myself, to tell you the truth. And then later that day, when I finally drove home to Long Island, I got home just in time for my parents. My father was having his cup of coffee, getting ready to go to work. He worked in a defense plant, believe it or not. And Frank loved this story. I walked in, and I was still in my tuxedo, and I'm just gushing how I just spent the last 4 hours with Frank Sinatra, blah, 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 blah. And I noticed my father hadn't even looked up from the newspaper. He hears his buddy's horn out front, and he folds up the paper, and he puts it down, takes his coffee cup, he goes over to the sink, and he's rinsing it off. He goes out in the hall, and he's putting on his jacket and his hat. And I said to Mom, I said, excuse me a minute. I went out in the hall, I says, Dad, and he's not even looking at me. He says, yeah. I says, were you listening? I just spent the last 4 hours with Frank Sinatra, and I played, and he sang with me and everything like that. And as he turns, as he's grabbing the doorknob to walk out the door, he looks at me and he says, does that mean I can retire now?
Oh, jeez. That was his response.
Oh, yeah. Man. But the PS of the story is later on that afternoon, I canceled all of my private students that day because I was exhausted. And I said to Mom, I'm going to go pick up Dad at work. And typical winter in New York, I'm sitting there in the parking lot of the factory, 5:30, and everyone's punching out. And one by one, all of my dad's friends that knew me came by the car, and they're knocking on the window saying, hey, Tony, that's great. Congratulations, man. But my father told every single one of them, but he wouldn't give me any credit whatsoever.
Yeah, but you know, but it must have on the back end, at the very least, because you probably knew your dad and knew what type of guy he was and how he was going to react, that hearing it from his friends that he was proud of you and he was excited for you.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You were talking a little bit about Uncle Frank. You know, people, when they hear the word Uncle Frank, if they're a big fan of the Jimmy Kimmel Show, that was his uncle. That was the security guy on stage. And I remember hanging out backstage with you and Don and Barbara Rickles some years ago talking about Uncle Frank. And I had no idea that he was a policeman, but he also served as security for Sinatra himself. He was in that circle.
Yeah, well, when he retired from the NYPD, now, it's funny because Jimmy's Uncle Frank and Jilly's brother Frank were two different people, obviously. But Jilly knew Frank Potenza, Jimmy Kimmel's Uncle Frank, from New York, when he was a cop.
Yeah.
So when he retired from NYPD, because the rest of the family had already taken up root and moved to Las Vegas. I mean, Jimmy was born in Brooklyn, and I think he left and moved to Vegas when he was like 4 or 5. So Uncle Frank picked up with Aunt Chippy and the three girls and moved to Las Vegas. And so he got in touch with Jilly, and he said, listen, you know, I'm in Vegas. I'm new. I don't know anybody. And Frank is under contract at Caesars. Do you think maybe you could put in a word? Maybe I'll get a job as a security guard there. And that's partially how it came to be.
Wow.
And if you're familiar with Uncle Frank, God love him, Potenza, he was a character and a half. And sometimes he'd be in his own world. And it wasn't intentional. It's just who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And I told Jimmy this story one time that I happened to be up in Vegas and was in touch with Jilly. And he says, listen, I'll call you tomorrow when the old man gets up. Maybe you can join us. We'll grab some breakfast. Well, breakfast is 3 p.m., naturally. So he calls me up and he says, listen, the old man doesn't want to eat in the suite. We're going to go down to the coffee shop, but meet us at the suite and we'll walk down together. Okay. So I met them at the suite, and who's standing outside the door, because he was appointed to be security because that's how he got the gig.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Uncle Frank Potenza. So we get in the elevator. Well, downstairs, we're walking across the casino floor to get to the coffee shop, and a guy looks up from the crap table, and he sees Sinatra, and he yells across the room, "Hey, Frank, how you doing, buddy?" And before Sinatra got a chance to open his mouth, Uncle Frank Potenza goes, "Pretty good. I got a nice job. I'm making a living. I ain't gonna complain." And Sinatra looked at me and Jilly, and he says, "Am I in the room or what?"
That's awesome. So let's talk a little bit about Jilly. And not only was he a very close friend of Frank's, he was a big part of Sinatra's life, but he was a friend of yours and he was a mentor to you.
Yes, he was. He surely was. And I don't know if I'd ever have, well, I might have met Mr. Sinatra at some point, eventually a different way, but no way with the endorsement that came with Jilly having his arm around me and the trust that was automatically in place as a result of that. And Jilly was a hell of a guy. He really was. He helped a lot of people during his life. And in his mind, his enjoyment and his payback was watching people get where he felt they deserved to be. That's just the kind of guy he was. He was just a big guy, you know. He was an impressive man, and he had a very big presence. But at the heart of the matter, he was really just a sweetheart.
State player on 720 WGN. We're talking to Sinatra friend, confidant, and manager Tony Opitasano. His book is Sinatra in Me, in the Wee Small Hours. You would be, on the road with Frank, and you've shared some stories on how some of the best moments of his shows, just as a performer, like you know, you were in his circle, you were in his management team, but some of his best performances were unplanned on stage. And a lot of it was changing lyrics to songs, adapting it to the city, or just being funny because he was just having fun with the audience.
Yeah, you know, I to clear up the technicality of it, I became his road manager when Jilly passed away, and that was my capacity, for 3 years while he continued to work. But yeah, he would have fun. He would have fun with stuff. I mean, there was a great song, and he liked to just see if the audience would get it sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he started singing one night, "You're nobody and nobody loves you. You're nobody and nobody cares." Now that's not the original lyric,
right.
But obviously, Mr. Saturday. Well, that one I can't tell. That's dirty.
Okay.
She went upstairs to get undressed. She came down without a chest. It's magic. Those kinds of things.
Yeah. But
he loved doing that.
You know, you toured with him. You were obviously in awe of his music and his style and his persona. But, you know, you were a stage performer as well. I mean, you were singing in clubs. You were out there doing that. And obviously, being in Frank's circle and part of his team, was it a difficult decision for you, or an easy decision, to join Frank, but some disappointment of not being on stage yourself?
You know, it's kind of like a bit of an ache that never goes away. Because let's face it, it was a big part of myself that I thought I was going to be doing for the rest of my life. However, I gave up my performing career in the early 80s only because it seemed like the smart thing to do. I had to keep compromising, as I used to say, my musical integrity just to continue to work. I was no longer doing the Great American Songbook because the industry itself had its hand in turning the public away from that, and the attention was going to disco, and then from disco it went to grunge, and from grunge to heavy metal. And so I turned my sights on producing, and I was doing TV and film and doing more and more things with Jilly as a result of that. He was helping me get talent, people that I didn't know. And also we started handling people together, like Joey Villa. And so we were doing more and more things together. And as the way it worked out, I spent more and more time down in the desert. So it only reinforced my friendship with Frank, starting in the early 80s and through the mid 80s. And then, you know, when the time came, unfortunately, when Jilly left us, by then I was already someone that Frank implicitly trusted. And it seemed like a natural fit. For me to end up where I was at the end of his life.
You said radio and stuff kind of turned people away from the Great American Songbook. And I know Frank detested, he wasn't a big fan of rock and roll, obviously. And, you know, he felt some of the bigger singers of the day on his coattails a little bit, but he did some albums in the late 70s and the 80s, you know, even into the very early 90s, that really did kind of capture some of those more contemporary pop culture songs, but totally in his style.
In his own style. And, you know, I got to give credit where credit is due on that. I was and still am a huge fan of Nelson Riddle. However, due to both Bill Miller and Al Viola, they are the ones who had a bit of a hand in convincing Frank to try this other arranger, a monster by the name of Don Costa. And Don Costa, and I should never have left out Billy May or Gordon Jenkins, obviously. But Don Costa is the guy who kind of brought Frank as close to exactly what was happening, you know,
in music
contemporaneously then.
Yeah.
And again, as I've said in another interview, I think, with you, part of the reason that he went to that self-imposed retirement, in addition to wanting to spend more time with his friends and family, is that he, and he told me this in later years, he was not convinced that he was relevant to my generation and had anything to offer us.
It's amazing when you think about the greatest, you know, singer of the 20th century is Sinatra, that he felt that way about himself.
Well, that's how much of a regular guy he was,
yeah.
You know. You know, that other persona was built up in the press and everything else. When you got to know the man, he was as sensitive about things like that as you or I would be. And he also felt that he owed the general public the very best that he could do, because as he used to say, these are the people that paid the freight that got me where I am. And if I can't give them the very best that I'm capable of, then I'll walk away. And it's a very difficult thing to do, but that's how dedicated he was to his craft.
I think it was somewhere in Europe. It was Don and Jilly and Frank and you, and you're all having a bunch of drinks and probably overserved a little bit. It's a great story if you could share that.
Yeah, he was actually there on holiday and was sitting in the lounge, and all of a sudden this horrific thunderstorm came blowing in.
And there were musicians on stage and were listening to music, but all Frank noticed was the flashes of the lightning. And he turned and he said, "Tell those damn guys if they don't stop taking my picture," because we were sitting against a plate glass, "if they don't stop taking them, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to take that damn camera and blah, blah." And so,
that's awesome.
outside they go, and they're going, "What are we going to do? It's a storm. What the hell?" Well, luckily, the storm was moving very quickly, and it was moving in the direction away from where we were. So they stayed outside for about 10 minutes. They came back in, and there was absolutely all of it was gone. And Frank looked over and says, "Nice job, guys. That's terrific."
That's great. One of my favorite stories, honestly.
I never saw Don Rickles cross himself as though we were Catholic before.
I bet.
State player on 720 WGN. We're talking to Sinatra friend, confidant, road manager Tony Opitasano. His book is Sinatra and Me in the Wee Small Hours. You know, you open and close the book with some impactful stories about the end of Frank's life. And first, he trusted you. First of all, he gave you some great gifts, over the years. That, you know, are still near and dear to your heart?
I guess probably the single most important, because of what it represents, is when he asked me, we're down in the desert. This is not long before he gave up the compound and moved up to Los Angeles permanently for the rest of his years. And he said, "I'd like you to do me a favor." We were sitting out by the pool. It was about 4 a.m. And I said, "Sure, anything." And he says, "I'll meet you in the theater." He had this freestanding theater. You wouldn't know that that's what it was. It looked like it was a beautiful building, and it had big sofas and a bar. But at the end of the room, there was a screen behind the drape. But anyway, I went into the theater, and a few minutes later, he comes out of the house, and he walks into the theater with this valise in his hand, and he puts it down on the table, and he says, "The contents of this valise," he says, "are things that I've been putting aside," he says, "since the 1930s, he said, "and for the record, every single thing in this valise, predates my relationship with Barbara. So when the right time comes, and you'll know when that is," he said, "I would like for you to make certain that the contents of this valise gets to my blood relatives, to my children, and to Mrs. Nancy." He says, "I don't want the contents of this valise to become part of a tug of war between Barbara and the kids." And I said, "Fine, Frank, I'll take care of it." And he proceeded to open it up and take the items out one by one and explain what they were and how they came to be and all of that stuff. And then he closes it up and he said, "And you know, I have something I need to give you too." I said, "Frank, it's not necessary." And he says, no, please." And he pushes this jewelry box across the table. He says, "I want you to have that." And I opened it up, and it was the pinky ring with his family crest on it. Wow. And he said, "I want you to know something else about that ring." I said, "Okay." He said, "First of all, I've come to think of you as an extended part of my family." He says, "So I really want you to have that." He says, "And further to that," he said, "you know, I used to wear that very ring on my left hand." He says, "But when I married Barbara, I put a wedding ring on my left hand." He says, "And I tried to put that on my right hand, but as you know, I broke my hand doing Manchurian Candidate, and my pinky calcified, and it never quite healed, and that ring would not fit over his knuckle. So he had a replica of it made, and that's what he was wearing for the rest of his life. And so he said, I want you to have that." Wow. And I was very, very overwhelmed with that, and I still wear it on my right hand to this day. I didn't have to even resize it, believe it or not.
Yes, you do.
And, there's more to the story, but that I'll save that because it's politically incorrect. But at least I got him to laugh, like he got me to laugh as a result of it.
Right. Well, you were hanging a lot.
And the other,
you'll get him, sir.
The other part of it, which I'm sorry to interfere because I want you to know, I think you do know, Frank did respect me as a musician and a singer, And he also lamented that I gave up my performing career because he knew that it bothered me that I knew that I would never earn a gold record as a singer. I've earned gold records as a producer, but I've never owned, you know, earned a gold record as a singer. And so in addition to giving me this ring, when I got back to my condo in Toluca Lake a week and a half or so later, there was a package waiting. And I said, well, what the hell is this? I just left them. And I opened it up, and there's a short note, and it said, this is for you. There's no discussion. And I unwrapped it. Not only was it one of his gold records, it was his gold record of My Way.
Oh. Oh. Wow.
And I almost fell onto the floor. And just to cheer you up a little bit, I picked up the phone out of reflex and I called the house and I spoke with Vine, and we used to have a code word jokingly. And she picks up the phone. I said, is the gorilla up? And she said, yeah, he's having his breakfast. So it was about 4 p.m. he's having his breakfast. I said, would you please tell him I'm on the phone and I need to speak with him? So she pulls the phone away from her ear and she said, Mr. S, yes, sweetheart, Tony O's on the phone and he wants to talk to you. And I heard Frank chuckle, and I'm going to clean up the language. I heard him chuckle, and he says to her, tell him to read the note again.
That's awesome. Great.
And he wouldn't talk to me.
No, right. right. Well, again, I mean, that was your relationship, and it was like that for decades. And, you know, you so often hung out with Frank at their home and spent a lot of time with one another. But at the end, you know, your presence was, you know, also allowed Barbara to get out of the house while providing Frank with some companionship that he needed. And you were there for those final moments of Frank's life. And I don't think either of you would have had it any other way.
No, it's something that I treasure. And as I've said, it may sound perverse to some people, but I also treasure the fact that I was afforded the opportunity to literally be with him as he passed, as he left this plane, because I don't know how I would have handled it, given our relationship, if I had just gotten a phone call and said, listen, I got bad news, Frank died. I honestly don't know. I mean, it was extremely emotional, obviously, but it was also a bit comforting knowing that he passed very peacefully and Barbara was standing by my side, and just the two of us. Even Dr. Kenemer had the good sense to leave us alone in the room because there was nothing more they could do for him. And it was just a moment that it's locked in my memory for the next 10,000 years, trust me.
We've only touched upon a few of the stories in this amazing book, including that story about Frank Sinatra. Sinatra and Me in the Wee Small Hours. You can pick it up at Amazon and at your local bookseller as well. Tony, always love spending time talking to you, my friend. You know, just in general, we have a great time having conversations and stuff, but your Sinatra stories are always legendary, and I'm so glad you put them into this book because it's really just a tremendous read.
Thank you, my friend, and it's always an honor for you to ask me to come on your program, and a smile comes to my face whenever I look down, no matter when it is, and I see that you're giving me a call.
Awesome.
And I appreciate your friendship and your support more than I can tell you.
As do I. Thanks, buddy, and I can't wait for the new book. I'll read that after you're gone.
I'll come back and visit you and see how you like it.
I know you will. Right, thank you. Tony Opisano, Sinatra and Me. Thanks, buddy.
Take care, pal.
All right. Top stories for the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom are next here on 720 WGN.